dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Next Tuesday, April 6th, the trial of four peace activists from the Ithaca Catholic Worker Community will begin at the Tompkins County Courthouse on Tioga Street at 9 a.m. The activists, known as the St. Patrick's Day Four, are facing felony charges which carry a maximum four-year sentence. On March 27th, the defendants learn that their chance to defend themselves has been curtailed. Judge John M. Sherman ruled in a written decision that the four will be limited in their assertion of the defenses of necessity and international law. In his ruling, Judge Sherman prohibited any expert witnesses or documentary evidence relating to necessity or international law, but said that the defendants could speak of these matters in their personal testimony. He found that there was, quote, no applicability of international law in the present case, and that the, quote, proffered proof does not demonstrate the type of true emergency envisioned by the necessity statute. I don't understand how a so-called system of justice, which places the liberty and sometimes the life of a person at stake in the outcome of a trial, can deny a defendant any means to defend herself and still maintain its pretensions to justice. Tonight on the program, you will hear the voices of the activists, speakers on international law, documentary evidence of the criminality of the war on Iraq, of the choice that citizens must make between law and conscience, and the duty to engage in civil resistance. And we'll conclude the program with another reading from Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt, also on the question of maintaining one's values in the face of a coercive hierarchy. Over the past few months, Kenny Ritter and I conducted a series of interviews with the members of the Ithaca Catholic Worker Community, known as the St. Patrick's Day Four Defendants. We anticipated that the U.S. court system would be sure to close off many of the options for their defense. This commonly happens in cases where citizens assert their direct right to intervene in a confrontational way against the actions of government. In other words, when they behave as if they live in a society of equals. This is because, above all else, the state desires obedience to laws. Laws made by and for powerful interests, enforced by people in uniforms that the average person is expected to obey without question. These four people are average residents of Central New York, in that they are white, lower-middle-class, middle-aged people with children who confront the usual array of mundane problems. But they are far from average in that they've made a commitment to live their lives in accordance with their beliefs, to know where they stand and to stand there. Defendant Peter DeMott.
The 17th of March, St. Patrick's Day of 2003, Danny Burns, who traveled to Iraq with me, and two of my sisters-in-law, which is to say Claire and Teresa Grady, went to the Army and Marine Corps recruiting station in Lansing, and with a small quantity of our own blood, which we poured on the walls and on recruiting posters, and on the floor. And we also got a small quantity of blood on the American flag, which was displayed on one of the walls there. We wanted to manifest and demonstrate our opposition, our nonviolent, peaceful opposition to this war in a very graphic, very realistic way. And so we chose to use this symbol of blood, the blood, of course, representing the loss of life of, up till now, over 500 GIs that we know about. And because I think it's important to remember that in war, truth is the first casualty, and it's not just assaulted and killed once. It's a casualty over and over and over again during war. But anyway, the American death toll right now is about 500, but the other members of the coalition have also suffered losses. I guess the British have lost about 50 or maybe closer to 60 now. And other countries, the Spaniards and the Italians, have also incurred heavy losses relative to their proportion of proportionate to the number of soldiers they have there. But the overwhelmingly the number of Iraqis is probably upwards of 15,000. And it's important for everybody to know that in modern warfare, the casualties are 90% or better are innocent children and women and elderly people and what we would call non-combatants, you know, people that are just happen to be in the way or in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the Pentagon refers to them as collateral damage. But we are convinced that this war, which has claimed all these lives, was totally wrong, and we knew that at the time, and we knew we could tell, you know, from late in as early as 2001, when the build up to the war was really being given serious play in the media, that this war was wrong and unjust and need not have happened, that a peaceful solution could have been reached at some point. And so we wanted to voice our opposition, and so we went to the recruiting station and poured our blood and then stood and waited to be arrested. And the point we were trying to make was that it's better for us to use this symbol and to try to demonstrate to the public and to one another that this human life, this precious human life, especially the lives of innocent people, need not be shed. And that we really needed to be speaking out in a nonviolent way against our military leadership, against Mr. Bush and his associates who have dragged the country into this war, and telling them that it was wrong and immoral and unjust, and that it was only going to be very counterproductive, that the hatreds and the desire for revenge that were going to be created would come back on us, and we would be paying for it in terms of the cost to human life and suffering for years and years to come.
I got word that at Scott Ritter's prediction that we were going to commit 200,000 troops to invade Iraq. That was in March of 2002.
Defendant Claire Grady.
I began working. We did a public vigil and walk to the recruiting center, holding a sign that I held that said, "To send troops is to send our most precious resource." That's what I get. This was on Good Friday. So that was 2002. Went on to, in June, being part of delegations that went to lobby our senators and congressmen in Washington. That was in June. We held speakers events. We held the weekly vigil. We did marches through town. We did marches through the mall. We did sit-ins. We did, and again, more speakers, petitions, leafleting, getting stuff on TV. We did everything we could. We did a spectrum of all of these things that, of course, they would like to restrict you to only those things that don't risk arrest. But we did all of those things. We were doing it a year beforehand, just working nonstop. I know Javon Garrett was fond of saying, "You could have rented a hall and had a talk." Well, we did. We did a whole lot more, and very notable, trying to even talk to our representatives in Washington. This was set up in conjunction with many Quakers. You can't get any more kind and humble people, the Quakers, and they would call and call and call to get, like, for Schumer's office to get an appointment. He would never answer the phone calls. We ended up going in person when we got there and saying, well, you never answered our phone calls. We'd like to speak. Well, we don't have anybody. Oh, wait a minute. We have somebody right here, as he walked in. But it was not easy to get the ear of our representatives. We had to work very hard to get the ear of our representatives. And then we know what they did with this public outpouring, just like put it to the side. When you ask that question about what was happening in March of 2003, it brings up very strong feelings for me, because with the heightened awareness that really this war on the people of Iraq was being escalated, we were right there on the brink of this invasion, that this administration was going to go forward regardless of what the people felt. These gangsters are just running roughshod over democracy. When you talk about committing troops, just about everybody feels that one. Nobody wants to put our young people in harm's way. So even if people were afraid of Saddam Hussein because the media spun that one so well, because the administration spun that lie so well, people were all feeling heavy about this. The popular uprising, and I say uprising, it was so powerful. I mean, we'd stand up, for years we were standing on the street every week in this weekly vigil, and at that time, it was just, the numbers were growing. People would just come out of nowhere and join this line, like 30 people in the freezing cold morning. And people driving by were just unanimously giving the thumbs up for peace, for not bombing. And around the world, we were given stories of millions, people coming out in the millions to say no to this war. That it was not okay to bomb the people of Iraq with this notion of preemptive war. It is not okay. It is the height of barbaric behavior and lawlessness. And in this country, we know that every senator's office was getting flooded with calls. Just about 99% of them were saying no to the war. We know this. How did those senators respond to that?
Professor Christian Scherer is a senior researcher in conflict studies at the Hiroshima Peace Institute in Japan.
Iraq has been under aggression all along since 12 years. We have had almost daily attacks on Iraq. Iraq has been sliced in three parts. Two zones in the north and in the south have been self-declared by the aggressors as no-fly zones for the Iraqis. So this has not been accepted, as you know, by Iraq. So I have to remind this conference that the main killer in the Iraq was not the EU nor other weapons of mass destruction. The EU is definitely a weapon of mass destruction because not only kills present generation, but future generations of victims. So it couldn't be more mass destructive as it is. We have to open ourselves to the fact that 2 million Iraqis died from UN sanctions, which were abused by the United States and by Britain, chiefly by the United States. These sanctions have been used in a way that inflicted a very high death toll, and me and my colleagues believe that actually this is the best prosecutable case if we look at accountability issues, because we not only have the facts presented in secret documents which were declassified. These are documents by the defense intelligence agencies. But the case goes further. We never had such a thing. If you look at the EU, we have actually the highest official involved in the killing, admitting the killing. You know, we had Madeleine Albright telling at CBS 60 Minutes that killing 500,000 Iraqi children was worth it. She couldn't prove what was worth it, of course. And it didn't even work in their own theory because it had no impact on the regime. It actually reinforced the grip of the Saddam's dictatorship. What we see in the Iraq is a complete disorder. 50 Iraqis are being killed every day by the occupiers. We don't read about that. It's not reported. What is reported that two or three American soldiers were killed the same day. That's reported. And more than 50 people die every day by just normal criminality. But this is not a normal criminality, because if you take away the state, if you take away all the institutions, this is to be expected. And actually, according to international law, the occupier is liable for these things happening now.
Defendant Teresa Grady.
What was on my mind were letters from our friend Kathy Breen, who was in Iraq from October of 2000 through the invasion up until the end of April of 2003. Kathy wrote us practically weekly, sometimes every other week, because of her ability to get access to a computer to email folks. She gave us a picture of what was going on there and the kind of horror that people were having to live under in anticipating being bombed. Because of the sanctions, people were quite impoverished already. She was describing one of the families as a mother who is widowed. Her husband was killed in the first Gulf War. And she was an artist, is an artist, and so she was trying to sell her painting and her work as her livelihood and her living. There's really not much, or at least from what I understood and from the letters, not a whole lot of work to be had. Kathy would go to her house and take Arab lessons from her older child. At one point was going out to a park for the birthday of one of these children, you know, trying to get the picnic together and kind of real typical kind of family event, but very simple at the same time. I think balloons they had, but very, very simply pulled together, and every piece was very important though, even as simple as it was, sitting there in the park with the fear of planes flying over, because it could mean the beginning of they didn't know when the bombing was going to occur. Knowing if your neighbor was going to live, or whether you would live, or whether your house would be bombed, or, you know, whether your child would run into a cluster bomb and become maimed. These kinds of things were very real and very frightening to people. And so they tried to have some semblance of sanity and normalcy by having this birthday party out in the park. But there was this underlying tone of real fear for the people there. Some of the other letters that she wrote, she wasn't able to go and see these families once things got tighter and tighter. You know, it kept getting closer to the time of shock and awe, and so they were limited for where they could travel within Baghdad and how they could get around, just because of, you know, and the people at the hotel, the workers there were leaving to go with their families, to stay with their families. They wouldn't come back to work because, and so it was just a ghost town, I think, in at the very end there. What I guess I remember most was just the horror and the mental stress and duress that we caused of people, a large number of people. Imagine having to just get up out of your home and leave with the things that you could carry in your hands. You know, some of us can do that, but most of us, I'd bet, have a harder, much harder time with that.
There seems to be a disconnect, a vast chasm between the American experience and was perceived to be a different experience in Iraq. You touch on the fact that raising your children, having no medical care, are things that Americans are concerned about. Why is it different here in America.
We kind of live in la-la land here.
Defendant Daniel Burns.
What's the biggest problem you had today, you know? My biggest problem was I was watching a movie, and I had to come and drop a... I walk dogs for a living, and I had to drop a dog off, and then I had to thought, well, I have to get gas. I got to go all the way to the gas station, pull up, pump gas, and then go. And then I was thinking, you know, well, I could go to the health club now, and then and I felt bad because I didn't, you know, I haven't been to the health club in 3 days. That, and it's bothering me. Now, these are luxury problems, you know. I got to go get gas, which is completely plentiful, available, and abused by me. I mean, I drive, and I, you know, I'm a gas guzzler for peace, you might say, but part of my job is to, I have to use the car. You know, I'm a member of a health club. I get to go buy groceries. I have a selection of different grocery stores to go to. I can buy any kind of food I want. I was in Iraq. Everything that they tell you here on the news, you have to know that it's so much worse than you can imagine. I mean, the suffering is a daily thing. It's just a grind. Every faucet leaks. The water, 60% of the water is not, you can't potable. You can't drink it. It gives you diarrhea. And you don't know when it's going to be good. It could be good one day and not another. There's no gasoline. There's lines. The line's literally miles long. People pushing their cars up to the pump, waiting overnight in a country with the second largest gas or oil reserves in the world. What if you're sick? What if your baby's sick? You have kids. You have children. And you hold your son, and he's sick, and he's got diarrhea. Or he's, you know, we saw some kids with cancer and from, you know, depleted uranium, and they don't have any medicine. And it's 8 months after the invasion and the preceding 12 years of the sanctions. If the people in the United States and in Britain could imagine what that would be like for a father or a mother, if they could remember what it's like to hold a baby, and what they feel is no different than what, you know, Iraqis feel about their children. What about the American soldiers who are getting killed? A lot of them are fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters. They're being torn apart. I don't see any of Bush's children in the army. I don't see Rumsfeld's kids there. I don't see any of them. And all the people have decided to go. None of them have anything at stake in this except making a lot of money. Leading up to when the bombing started, people were coming out in the street. There were rallies, there were marches, there were protests. In New York City, 1 million people showed up in like a 10-degree weather. Now, I know that if one person shows up to a march or a rally, it's the equivalent of 5,000. That's how the polling people do it. Anyway, so when 1 million people show up in New York, and the Bush administration just doesn't even think about it, like it's not happening. They don't even address it. But we got this guy in there who, you know, you have to understand who we're dealing with. We're dealing with somebody who knows he didn't win the election, yet took office anyway. And then stands up there and pretends like, you know, hey, like with a swagger, like he did. Which, you know, the credibility and the character of the man, Bush, W., is so awful. I mean, could you imagine doing that in a sporting event or in anything at a job? I just don't understand how people can accept it and think it's okay and forget about it. You know, people are driving around or they're walking down to the commons and, you know, they're worried about their taxes going up because their house, their fuel costs, the library's not going to be open on Sunday. Oh, that's the end of the world, isn't it? How would you know, and you go to Iraq, there are no more libraries. They have all been looted. There is no garbage pickup. There's no electricity. It comes on, all of a sudden it comes on, and there you are, you got lights for a while, and then, you know, you're sitting there having a conversation, and then pitch black, and then that's it. You're in the dark.
So why should we care as Americans? Do these people, haven't they brought it on themselves?
The funny thing is that, we are responsible for it. And if you pay your federal income tax, just about 50% goes to the war machine. And the sanctions were enforced by the United States under the guise of the UN. They were there for 12 years. The first Gulf War, Saddam invaded Kuwait. How did Iraq get Saddam? Well, Saddam was actually recruited by the CIA when he was in college in Turkey in the 50s. And he was placed in the power in Iraq by the United States. I mean, literally, quite literally. And we basically punished an entire society because of Saddam Hussein, who lived in palaces during the entire time. You know, he ate anything he wanted, and his, you know, he did not suffer. He couldn't leave his country, but he did not suffer. And then when you look at what it did to the population, the civilian population in Iraq, it made them actually have to rely more on Saddam than ever before, because whatever he gave them is all they could get. It's such a punishment, such a tragedy. And anyway, the sanctions are vengeance. We can't lift the sanctions. What about Saddam? We got to get Saddam. But during the sanctions, 5,000 children a month died as a direct result of the sanctions, the UN sanctions on Iraq. Saddam's fine. All these babies are dying. And the Iraqis know this. They remember this. This happened to them, and they know it was us. Then you have them coming in and invading, and then you have them putting in their, appointing their so-called coalition government, or whatever they're calling it. Then you have them putting in all these contracts, giving them to, you know, Halliburton and all their subsidiaries, and all these other contracts that are going in for literally everything. Cell phones, that contract was awarded, not to Iraqis. The infrastructure, to rebuild the infrastructure, you know, for the oil refineries and all the infrastructure for to pump it, get it to the refinery and get it out of the country to sell it. It's Iraqi land, it's Iraqi oil. They give the contracts to American corporations.
Defendant Peter DeMott.
In war, which is really organized mass murder, human life is wasted on a colossal level. And I myself, as a Vietnam veteran, I served in Vietnam in the Marine Corps. I was there almost all of 1969. I just came away from that experience with the realization that war is never the answer. War just perpetuates a cycle of violence. Modern weaponry is so lethal, and potentially, you know, could result in the deaths of millions and millions of people. In a nuclear war, it certainly could claim the life of the whole human race. So that was certainly a motivation for us. I don't think a lot of people realize that the United States, has been using depleted uranium munitions in Iraq, and somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 tons. In the first Gulf War, 1991, they used about 375 tons of depleted uranium munitions, but in this most recent war, somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 tons. And the most terrible thing about the depleted uranium is that it aerosolizes upon impact. They're armor-piercing shells, which burn and can penetrate very heavy, you know, thick steel or other otherwise impenetrable surfaces and armor plating. And on impact, they aerosolize, and the radioactive particles have become airborne, and then will get into the air, the soil, the water, and are readily inhalable or ingestible, either through food or water or whatever. And they will result in widespread disease. And the terrible thing about them is that they remain highly toxic for millions of years. And to think that our government would use this sort of a weapon, it just further confirms to me how completely out of touch with reality they are.
I am Dr. Jawad Ali. I am a consultant physician, and I am the head of Department of Medicine at the Teaching Hospital in Basra. And at the same time, I'm the manager of the Cancer Treatment Center in Basra, which provides treatment for the 3 southern districts of Iraq. First slide. This is my hospital, where the Cancer Treatment Center is located. It is totally damaged by at least 12 missiles during the war, two of them fallen in the garden of the hospital, and it killed four of our patients, and it destroyed the whole hospital, the windows, the doors, and the lifts. And since then, until now, I have 13 patients of the staff who work in the hospital at that time. They got cancer. Eight of them are doctors, and the rest are from the paramedical staff. It is estimated that 800 tons of depleted uranium is delivered over the whole area of Iraq, and at least 300 tons delivered to the western part of Basra. Next one, please. And the level of radiation has been studied by the engineering department, environmental engineering department of the College of Engineering, University of Baghdad. It was 10 times more in the air and about 10 to 5,000 times in the soil. 45% of the people in the area are at risk of getting cancer from radiation. What are the health consequences due to depleted uranium, which we noticed in Basra? We have an increased incidence of cancers, increased incidence of congenital malformations and abortions, and we have appearance of diseases of unknown etiology, possibly due to toxicity with depleted uranium, and these are the muscle diseases, neuropathies, that is nerve disease, and kidney failure, and other diseases like the bloody diarrhea, which is mentioned yesterday. And I noticed also as a physician that we have an increased number of patients who suffer of a wheezy chest, and this is possibly due to fibrosis of the lungs. Again, we have strange phenomena appear after the 1991 war. These phenomena, one of them is the clustering of cancer, of familial cancer. We collected many families. Until now, I have 58 families with more than one member in the family affected by cancer. And one of the families, we have 8, 10 patients in the same family with cancer. And the other phenomena is the appearance of double cancer, a patient with two cancers at the same time. I got a patient with the three cancers, cancer of the stomach, cancer of the kidney, right, and then now we discover another cancer in the left kidney. The cancer mortality also is studied, and it's increased more than 19 folds within 12 years. And in 2002, the last year, it was 123 patients for each 100,000 of the population. And this means that we have more than 10 times increase in the incidence within 10 years. This figure, if we compare it to the WHO figure, it is 2.5 times. The WHO figure, as far as I know, it's 52 per 100,000. So this is 2.5 times the WHO figure, and is significant. Of course, our registration is underestimated. We are not registering all the patients. Even this mortality is lower than what we expect. At least 20% of the patients are not registered as cancer patients. They died because of something else. And also we have a change in the pattern of cancer. The cancers which are seen in elderly people now, we see them in a very young age groups. This is distribution of five common cancers. That is a prevalence per 100,000 of population in different parts of Basra, five common cancers. And you could see here the most prevalent cancer in the center of the city, Basra, is breast cancer. Then comes next lymphomas and leukemias. While in Zubair, the area which is very near to the battlefield, we have cancer of the lung. which is expected to have more cancer of the lung in this area. While in Gorna, that is the northern part of Basra, we have leukemias more, and also you could see lymphoma is, again, it's high. And in Fao, that is the southern part on the Gulf, we have cancer of the gastrointestinal tract is more, and this, I explain it because of the heavy shelling of the area by traditional bombs during the Iranian war, and the TNT in the bombs, it might cause a gastrointestinal, especially stomach cancer. And that's why we have more cancers of the gastrointestinal tract here. Next one, please. The evidence is to blame depleted uranium as a cause for these diseases after the Gulf War II. First of all, we have an increased levels of radiation in the area, and this is studied after the war. And we have an increased incidence of cancers, increased rate of mortality, according to many studies, and increased rate of congenital malformations. The types of cancers and their incubation periods are closely related to radiation, as leukemias. We found that leukemias appeared 3-4 years after the war, while the bone cancer and soft tissue cancers appears now. And then we have the strange phenomena, double familial and triple cancers are not seen before the war. I haven't seen. I worked in Basra for 34 years, and I haven't seen these phenomena. Most of leukemic children were born to fathers who were involved in the Gulf War. And the only cancer-inducing factor which is new after the Gulf War is the radiation factors. We have all the factors which induce cancer, from smoking or diet or infection, but we haven't got increased incidence before the war. And the only factor which has been changed is the radiation factor, which is due to depleted uranium. And now we'll show some picture quickly. Next one. These are my patients. This is a child of 2 years with an unHodgkin lymphoma, which is not seen usually at this age. It's a disease of elderly people. This child died after referring her to Dr. Jinan for treatment on the same day. Next one, please. Again, this is a child with, you see, his testicle is swollen, and he got a mass in his abdomen, and Dr. Jinan knows about his story. He died also in the pediatric hospital. This is 3 years old. Next one, please. This is a 13 years old child who died after a few months because of lack of medicines. And you see, it's an advanced case of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Next one, please. Again, this is a child of 14 years, and he got a big bone, a big swelling here due to bone cancer. And I think this is beyond treatment. He will not be cured. Still alive. I wish I could help him a lot. Next one, please. Again, this is a teacher with a muscle tumor, and the tumor is spread to the liver here and to the lungs to die after a few weeks. Next one, please. Again, this is a lady with a bone cancer spread to the chest, inside the chest, and you see the mass, it could be seen from outside. And I think she will die after a few weeks. Next one, please. This is again a girl of 17 years with the bone cancer. Next one, please. Again, this is the biggest tumor which I saw. This is called malignant fibrous histiocytoma, which is closely related to radiation. And the literature, it's recorded, very few cases are recorded. No more cases of this, but I recorded about 20 patients of malignant fibrous histiocytoma. Next one, please. Again, this is a military man, and he works in the Navy, and he got a malignant fibrous histiocytoma, and he received his first dose just 2 weeks ago of chemotherapy. You see, he's laughing. He doesn't know what's the future. Next one, please. Again, this is a 12-year-old child with a big mass in the abdomen, and you see, this is a non-Hodgkin lymphoma with infiltration of the breast. The other breast is normal. I gave her the first dose just a week ago before my travel. Next one, please. This is an acute myeloid leukemia, which is related to depleted uranium or radiation effects. And you see the bleeding site here. I think this patient will not survive more than 6 months. Next one. Again, this is a very big tumor, malignant fibrous histiocytoma. So this is closely related to radiation. Next one, please. Again, this is parotid tumor. Multiple operations are done to remove the tumor, but it recurred again and again. Next one, please. Again, this is a man who is living at the borders between Iraq and Kuwait in Safwan. And this man is injured here. He got a wound, and possibly it is contaminated by depleted uranium particles. To have a big tumor infiltrating the skull down to the brain, and he died after 1 month. Next one, please. Again, this is a soldier with a big abdominal tumor, and he died 1 month after admission to hospital.
My name is Lorraine Murray. I work with the Radiation and Public Health Project and study the health effects of nuclear power plants. But I also work with Marion Falk, a retired Manhattan Project scientist at the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab, where I worked until 1991 when I became a whistleblower. And he has taught me everything I know about radioactive fallout and rainout and how it cycles through the environment and through our bodies. This is something you can never learn in a university because they don't teach it and they don't want you to know. You can never learn it in a nuclear weapons lab because there they really don't want you to know. This is the nuclear weapons fallout map for the United States. 1,200 atmospheric bomb tests were done at the Nevada test site. Last November, the United States government admitted that every person who lived in the United States between 1958 and 1963 was exposed to radiation. What did it do to the fish in the North Atlantic? This is all government data. I'm showing you all U.S. or other government data. This is Norwegian government data. This was the fishing catch in millions of tons in the Atlantic. These are the Nevada A-bomb tests, the French Sahara tests, the Nevada tests. And in 1963, the U.S. and Russia signed the test ban treaty, ending their atmospheric testing. And you can see the fishing catch fell and fell and fell because the radiation that killed our babies in utero also killed the baby fish. And when you put plants or animals under stress and you remove that stress, the organisms recover. They make tremendous efforts to recover. And you can see that the fishing catch was even higher than before the radiation. What did this do to American children? This is the SAT scores for the entire, all of the children in the United States. And these are children born in 1940, 1945, World War II, when the atomic weapons started. This is 1963 when Russians signed the Tesfin treaties. And you can see that the SAT scores for all children in the United States were about 475. They declined with the additional burden of radiation each year to almost 420. And when we signed the Tesfin Treaty, the SAT scores improved and recovered.
What is SAT?
This is the Scholastic Aptitude Test, which is taken when a student is 18 years old in the last year of high school. And in order to get into college, this is one of the required things. So this is what they learned. This is the decline in SAT scores, and this is the kilotonnage of the nuclear weapons tests in Nevada. So you can see the more radiation, or the bigger the bomb, the greater the decline in the SAT scores, or the more damage to the brain of these children. What happened in the Pacific? And I'm sorry, this isn't a very good view graph. This is the Pacific fishing catch in millions of tons, and this is World War II. These are the Pacific A-bomb tests. These are more A-bomb tests. This is U.S., French, and Chinese Pacific tests. 1963 is when the test bomb was signed, the test ban treaty. But as you can see, the French and Chinese tests still affected the Pacific fishing catch, and also the Japanese have been contaminated with radiation because they're downwind from these Chinese and Russian tests. They like to say that lung cancer is due to smoking, but this is a view graph with women's smoking. You can see declining, but lung cancer in women increasing and crossing over. Clearly, smoking is not causing the greatest proportion of lung cancer. But if you look down here, the nuclear bomb tests, Three Mile Island accident. Here's the last atmospheric test. This is Chernobyl, underground testing, and then nuclear power plants, which I'll talk about in a minute. This is 1950, 1960, 1970, 1980, 1990. And this is 2000. What did the Native Americans think? The Native Americans where the uranium was mined in this area. Well, these are the words of Thomas Banyakya, the speaker for the Hopi elders. Uranium and lightning. We don't want these weapons made up of the uranium you take from our land. If you take the uranium, the lightning won't come and bring the rains. The uranium attracts the lightning. Take it away, and the lightning won't come. You have no right to take the lightning from us. And then his comment about being guardians and caretakers. The Navajos help guard the land for the Hopi. We don't want them to leave. This is their sacred land too. The white man is the one who needs to leave before nature intervenes. The Great Spirit made us caretakers of this land. We take care of it with our prayers and our ceremony. Now you poison it and rape it and destroy it with your strip mines and uranium tailings and power plants, all on sacred land. And you try to chase the last few Indians off so you can do your dirty work. This is where two-thirds of the deaths from breast cancer occurred between 1985 and 89. There are 110 nuclear power plants in the United States, and we have nuclear power plants so that the nuclear weapons program would have plenty of plutonium to build their bombs.
We have become aware and educated ourselves about the international laws that humankind has brought forth reflecting our evolution, which says basically you can't just kill.
Defendant Claire Grady.
You don't kill civilians. You don't poison their water. You don't poison their air. You don't kill. You don't destroy their crops that they depend on to eat. And you don't make weapons that don't discriminate between combatants and civilians. And we have developed a body of law that reflects, as I say, this evolution. Not that all of us start out thinking, well, what does the law say? Because I believe it reflects what's in our hearts, and the law catches up with that consciousness.
Karen Parker, J.D., is an expert in international law who has served since 1982 as a non-governmental delegate to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights and its subcommission on the illegality of depleted uranium weapons under international humanitarian law.
I found out about DU weaponry in 1996. And immediately began to condemn it at the United Nations Human Rights Forums. I was convinced that such weaponry could not be used without violating humanitarian or armed conflict law, and accordingly was already banned by operation of existing law. As a consequence of their use would necessarily constitute grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions and other violations of humanitarian law. The fact that the United Nations took up this issue as soon as I brought it up supports my opinion. The presentations at the 1996 session of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights and at the subcommission, which is now renamed the Subcommission on Promotion and Protection of Human Rights, focused on the use of DU weaponry in the Gulf, in the first Gulf War, for obvious reasons of time. The members were highly shocked and moved by the presentation of DU weaponry, many of them only finding out about DU for the first time. The subcommission in 1996 found the use of DU weapons incompatible with existing armed conflict and human rights law. What that means is it's illegal. Then the Balkan situation unraveled, and there was renewed interest in depleted uranium, not only because of concerns raised by the government of Iraq, but now the then government of the former Yugoslavia became very active in our anti-DU campaigning at the United Nations. When Justice CQN submitted his first report, which was submitted in 2002, as could be expected, the member from the UK strongly argued against it. However, most of the other members argued in favor of it, liked it very, very much indeed. In fact, did something rather unprecedented. And for this, I have to back off a little. When Justice CQN was given the assignment to do the paper, at the next session of the Commission on Human Rights, the United States and the UK carried out a campaign against him. He was up for re-election, and he was not re-elected. The US and UK thought that since he was no longer a member of the subcommission, that he wouldn't submit the report. It was a way of stopping the report. However, he submitted the report anyway, and the US and UK were very, very angry. In spite of their obvious anger at the subcommission session, the members of the subcommission, as I said, did something quite extraordinary. They asked Justice CQN to submit a follow-up paper, knowing that he was no longer a member of the subcommission, but at that time they did have authority to continue work with a non-member if they chose. They had only done it once before. So they asked Justice CQN to prepare a second paper. When the Commission on Human Rights met in the year 2003, this year, what the Commission on Human Rights did was pass a resolution taking away from the subcommission the right to appoint someone to do any work that was no longer a member of the subcommission. Obviously, this was a targeted resolution, targeted right at Justice CQN. And they expected that because of that, he would not submit the follow-up paper. However, he did submit the follow-up paper. The U.S. and the U.K. were very angry at that. It was very obvious from the statements of the member of the subcommission from the U.K. that what she was desperately trying to do yet again was take over the paper, and what she would do would be simply to rewrite it the following year. The subcommission rejected that completely and allowed the two reports of Justice CQN to speak for themselves. The subcommission made the decision that they had condemned depleted uranium and these other weapons. They had asked the Secretary General to do a report, which he did. They had listened to years of testimony. They asked a member to do a study, a paper, which he did, and a follow-up paper. And the subcommission said, you know, we have nothing else to say. DU weapons are illegal. We've written about it. We've shown it. We've demonstrated. We've did a legal analysis. The book is closed. Not in sense that they would, it was closed as far as direct action by the subcommission. So it went as far as the subcommission can go. The document is, these documents are official UN documents. They're out there circulating, and countries are on notice. It's important to know why depleted uranium is illegal, because there is no treaty condemning depleted uranium. So when there's no treaty, you have to now analyze the weapon in light of existing norms, which is what the subcommission process was all about. And it's also about what the International Court of Justice said in its 1996 opinion has to be done when there's no actual treaty. You use the whole area of customary international law. Well, first of all, let's set out the test for weapons. This test derives from, as I said, all of customary international law relating to armed conflict. Armed conflict law covers how wars are fought, meaning military operations. Humanitarian law governs what weapons are used in war and what military tactics are used with those weapons in war. And of course, humanitarian law has a whole body of law which protects victims of armed conflict. Looking at all three branches of humanitarian law, there are four rules derived from all of customary humanitarian law. One, when the war is fought, it can only be fought where the war is fought, against legal military targets. I know it sounds a little silly to say the war can only be fought where the war is fought and against legal military targets, but you can't have a war between country A and country B and attack country C and not have legal liability. And you can't target civilian or non-legal military targets. This is called the territory test. You can only have a war in the legal field of battle. Secondly, once again, it's going to sound a little simplistic. When the war is over, the war is over. When the war is all over, that means the instrumentalities, the material, the armaments of war must cease. This is called the time test. The war lasts as long as the war lasts. Applying that rule to weapons, obviously, is weapons have to stop when the war is over. The third rule about weapons